Welcome to Your Unique Brain, creatively connecting bodies, minds, and hearts of people living with a traumatic brain injury and others that are dealing with hypersensitivity. This is part two of the interview with Dr. Peter van Houten, practicing physician at the Sierra Family Medical Clinic in Nevada City, California, who has a special interest in the brain. In part one, we talked about a mild brain injury being an orphaned disease, what happens to the brain when it experiences trauma, why can't we think when we are emotional, the long-term effects of a mild traumatic brain injury, and what do we know now about TBI that we did not know years ago? This part of the interview will focus on the benefits of meditation and how it changes the functionality and the physical architecture of the brain. We will look at whether there is a limit on the adaptability of the nervous system to a constantly increasing, busier, faster, more stimulating environment using internet, many hours on the computer and cell phones. We will also look at karma and possible benefits of living with a traumatic brain injury or other health challenges. And I want to talk also about meditation. I know you have been meditating for many, many years, and there a lot of research has been done about the benefit of meditation and the impact on its brain. And what could you say to people that are dealing with a traumatic brain injury? Why would it be beneficial to them if they meditate?
You know, one of the things that even patients with brain injuries can take advantage of is that the brain itself is very plastic, very changeable. When we use the term plastic, we mean changeability. And the term we use for the brain is neuroplasticity, that both its structure and function can change depending on how you use the brain. And literally, you can tell 6 months after, you know, you could actually do a brain scan on someone who has taken up a brand new activity. Let's say this was actually a study that was done. They looked at the brains of taxicab drivers in London before and after they went through this very intensive training on becoming taxicab drivers, which takes 2 years there, to get a placard where you're allowed to be a taxi cab driver, where you really have to know the whole layout of London very completely to pass this test. And what they found is they could actually measure changes in one area of the brain that's associated with how we store maps in our brain, in our memory. And you could actually physically measure a difference in the size of that structure in their brain. Turns out it affected a part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is concerned with memory. It's one of its functions. And you could actually see a size difference after 2 years in the size of the hippocampus in these fellows that had men and women who had gone through training to be taxicab drivers in London. So that's just one example that you can actually cause not just functional changes in the brain and more interconnections and different kinds of connectivity in the brain, but actually the physical architecture of the brain gets changed. Meditation is profoundly helpful because it has such a significant effect on the prefrontal lobes and that governing effect on the limbic system, that instinctual and emotional center, that, you know, even someone meditating 12 to 15 minutes a day, which seems to be a good bare minimum to get many of the effects of meditation. You don't have to meditate 2 hours a day to get benefit from meditation. Really, it seems to be, you know, 12 to 15 minutes is a very good place for many people to start. That you end up having strengthening of the prefrontal lobes and the interconnections between the limbic system and the governance of the limbic system. And so many of the things we see with people even who've had traumatic brain injury, when they start meditating, they find that their emotions are under better control, that their ability to be in stressful environments is better, their ability to deal with somewhat stressful people has improved, their sleep patterns improve, their interest in recreational substances like alcohol or cannabis have gone down. So we can actually see very potent effects from this. The other thing that you hear from meditators is that their concentration gets improved. If there was probably one common theme I hear from my brain injury patients, is they all just say, I used to be really good at doing things, and now even when I'm interested in doing something, I can't concentrate to get it done. It's very hard for me to accomplish things. Because I have so much trouble staying focused on a task, and meditation addresses this directly. The last thing is that almost everybody experiences a boost in their mood, that they feel happier, their baseline level of mood is more interested in interacting with others, more interested in having a real life. So, and this, we see this begin to happen within just a few weeks of meditating regularly.
Mm-hmm. So that's a good encouragement to start or keep doing meditation.
And there's, and actually if you're someone who is new to meditation, for example, if you're just listening to this and you've heard about meditation before, but, you know, you haven't had a situation where you could have any instruction or training, one meditation option is you can go to the ananda.org. That's ananda.org. And they actually have free meditation lessons on there. And you can actually have someone help you for free with questions and actually get some guidance. And that's just one of many places you could look. It's one I particularly like because I help with it. That would be a very good place for someone to start. And again, 12 to 15 minutes a day.
With this nowadays constant bombardment to our senses, you know, with internet and cell phones and more traffic and busy and fast and louder and noisy and more light, I was wondering if you think there's a limit to what the nervous system can adapt to. And I know you don't use the capacity at all of our brain, but I was wondering if you think there's just a limit to what the nervous system can do.
Well, that's a very interesting question. I think our current estimates of what the brain is capable of fall very short of the possibilities. Actually, if I look historically at our understanding of the brain and its changeability, you just have to go back to 1980 to find a point at which, really, in the neurophysiology of neurology, or the neurology of the brain, the common understanding in medicine was that the brain really didn't change substantially after you were 25, except for the worst. You know, once you'd gone through all your development, and somewhere between age 23 and 25, you'd grown all the neurons you were going to grow, any changes in connections or how the brain actually functioned were done. And all you could do to the brain between then and when you died is to damage it. You couldn't do anything to improve it. So you can imagine someone waking up at age 30 and going, I'm an alcoholic, or I'm profoundly depressed, or I'm nervous all the time and none of my friends are, thinking that there was really no help for them in being different, except maybe to be medicated. And I think what we have seen since 1980 is, in fact, completely gone in the opposite direction. In fact, if there's anything that I would take as a takeaway in the trend in our understanding of how the brain has changed, is it seems like every time we try to say, all right, this is exactly how much the brain can possibly change. So maybe this is in 2005, and this is really what we know, and it's probably the brain can't change any more than this on its own. Well, here we are 10 years later in 2016, 11 years later, and we've suddenly discovered that there's tremendous interaction, for example, between the intestinal microbiome, our gut bacteria, and brain function, and significant interaction between the immune system and the brain that were really not well understood just 11 years ago. So, you know, I just feel like at this point, I have increasingly just felt not to put a limit on the end result, because I don't even think we have a glimmer yet of what that will look like. I would say we do understand that there's things in our current lifestyles which could be subtle ways of negatively impacting the brain that haven't been well understood yet. They're just being looked at now. And you actually made a comment about a couple of them. One is just the amount of internet connectivity and mobile devices that we're using. That if you overuse those things, they can have a deleterious effect on the brain. It's particularly harmful the younger you are. You know, if you're looking at a small child or a teenager, limiting screen time is even more important for them. But even for adults, I think there probably should be a cap on that, where, you know, you say, I'm going to spend this much time on the internet, and the rest of the time I'm going to be doing other activities which are healthy and helpful.
Especially for somebody who already has a compromised nervous system.
Yeah.
Their adaptability is also compromised to the stimulus.
It is. And your brain really begins to remodel itself and adapt itself to where it thinks you want to be in 6 months. It's always very forward-looking, and it's an automatic process that it's constantly doing. And its directional change in both structure and function occur based on how it sees us functioning right now and what experiences we're having right now. So, for example, if you wake up this morning and decide, you know, I would really like to start speaking French again. You know, I had a year of French when I was in high school. I'd like to be able to read French and speak French and maybe someday even go to France and do some traveling. And so you start studying French. Well, you'll have about 2 weeks where it's very slow going, and you feel like you're really not making much progress because your brain really hasn't kicked in yet to help you with that process. It's still sort of monitoring to see, well, how serious are you going to be about this, and how much of all the structural change that we can bring to bear should we bring to bear? And it takes time for some of these changes to occur. But usually around 2 weeks or so, people suddenly find they're making dramatic improvement in that new function. In this case, it was speaking French. They may find suddenly they've had a real improvement. If we went out to 1 or 2 months and we could somehow zoom in with a microscope and look at that area of their brain that's concerned with speaking French, we could actually see by 2 to 3 months, we could see improved connections occurring. So you don't have to be speaking French for 2 years before your brain is really physically responding. It's really in the first couple of months it starts to do that in a significant way. By 6 months, some of the gains that you've made become more permanent and would not go away unless you stopped speaking French for 2 or 3 years. So yeah, the brain is really anticipating where we're headed. So if the more we tend to be, you know, kind of imploded or just on our own or just on the internet, our brain begins to adapt to that being normal, whereas if we're doing things that are more helpful for our brain, we're meditating, we're getting some activity, some exercise, even if it's just walking, these are things that help the brain change in very positive directions.
My next question might be helpful for family and friends who have a hard time understanding what it is for their loved one to have a traumatic brain injury. Let's say they are together in a very complex environment. It's noisy, it's busy, a lot going on, and music and external movement. For a so-called normal person without an injury, a person can tune out stimulus, right, and eventually they don't hear all that noise or the air conditioning. But for somebody with traumatic brain injury, that situation is very different, right?
Absolutely. And in fact, I think for, you know, friends and particularly spouses or intimate loved ones, I think it's worth having a conversation to make sure that they understand how impactful some of these things are, because with their bodies and their nervous systems, they may not realize what kind of an impact a certain circumstance is having on the on you, the person who has had a traumatic brain injury. And so I think having, you know, some kind of verbal shorthand where the person who is very sensitive to certain environments can very simply say, you know, I'm just feeling kind of overloaded in this environment or with this particular conversation. Could we leave? Could we do something else? Would you mind if I went for a walk for 5 or 10 minutes and came back? Just so you don't have to have a big conversation about it, where there's some understanding that, you know, this is just like someone who has asthma and has sensitive lungs. If you put them in a room that's really smoky because people are smoking or there's incense burning or there's a real strong smelling substance in the room, like a strong perfume, their lungs may be really affected. And I think most spouses and family members would say, oh, if you're getting an asthma attack, please leave the room or we'll leave, you know, and I'll remember that for next time. And I think we have to have the same kind of sensitivity for our family members and loved ones who have had traumatic brain injury and just realize this is very real to them. This is not something they're just being overly sensitive. This is very uncomfortable for them and they're only going to bring this up as, please let's leave, if they really feel they need to.
And basically what happened in such situation is that the filter is not working in terms of the input. It's all like basically being attacked by the environment.
That's actually what it, that's what it would feel like for someone with a traumatic brain injury. Their ability to filter a lot of these noxious stimuli that are coming in, whether it's an annoying person or just some loud music, even as you mentioned, the sound of an air conditioner could just feel like someone scratching their fingernails on a blackboard to a TBI patient. And they may have to take that into account when they go into a situation. I think there can be desensitization. I think things like meditation are very helpful for TBI patients to help them be able to tolerate more things. But you have to be realistic about where you're at right now. And so do our loved ones and family members. Mm-hmm.
And now we're coming to my last question. I'm very curious what you're going to say about that. I know our connection is also through Ananda. And therefore, I'm going to use the word karma. Can you say just your opinion about looking at a TBI maybe as part of your journey, your karma, or maybe are there even any benefits to be gained from having to deal with that challenge that life handed you?
Well, and I think what I would say about this is that I think for all of us, we have specific experiences that we have. I would say it seems like in life we draw certain things to us, or, you know, it's ours to have a certain experience, and maybe that's a good relationship, maybe that's a brain injury. It kind of depends on who we are and what lessons we're going to learn in this lifetime. And to see it not something as just this is something that is terrible that has happened and there is nothing that I can do, I think that is probably the most unhelpful attitude to have. I think having an attitude of, oh, this is what's happened and what are some positive steps that I can take on this since it's mine to deal with, how can I work with this in a way that makes me stronger? And, you know, I would say this about many of the patients I've had over the years that have had various disabilities. The ones that have been able to put out enough energy to deal with it in a creative way and still have a life and have made adjustments that take into account that they do have some disability that they're working with, it's a great inspiration for other people. And they're happier. Not only are they happier, but they end up being an inspiration for others because many people have had injuries of various sorts that they're dealing with in their lifetime. And kind of depending on your philosophy, you could say that's fate or you could say, well, it's karma. But however you want to frame it, it's the reality of what we have to deal with and overcome. And I think most people would say, you know, I would rather be happy if I could be. And so looking at ways to address that and have that become the reality, I think that's the most helpful way to live.
Mm-hmm. And if people would like to read your post or information that you share, how can they get make contact with you?
An easy way to follow kind of the things that I read is on my Twitter feed. So I'm on Twitter, and I'm on there just as Peter Van Houten, three words, V-A-N space H-O-U-T-E-N, M-D. That's, you can find me just by typing those in on Twitter, and just follow me. And I follow a number of things in medicine, including traumatic brain injury and meditation, and try to post articles that I think would be of interest to a more general audience. I have a broad set of interests, and I'll also put things on about the weather or things that are happening geologically, just because they're part of my interest set. But I'd say 80% of what I post is really more focused on medical things and health-related things. I just posted one very recently looking at this study that I mentioned briefly that people with severe head injuries could have pituitary gland trauma, and that may be part of the reason that their recovery is so difficult. That's the kind of thing that I would post.
And could you also say a few more words about your clinic? I know that presently you personally don't accept new patients, but the clinic does.
Yes, actually, what we've tried to do with our health center here is to offer an environment where behavioral health and medical care are very intimately integrated, because, you know, we feel that if you don't take someone's behavioral health, their mental health, and have that closely integrated with their physical health, that you've missed a huge part of that person's health care. It's kind of the hallmark of the care we offer here. We're a community clinic, and so we accept all insurances as much as we possibly can. And our goal is to make sure that we don't forget that people have emotional health needs and mental health needs in addition to their physical needs, and all of that needs to be integrated together, and we tend to hire medical practitioners that pay attention to that.
Is there a website that people can go to?
Yes, our website is, I think it's sierraclinic.org. And it's a pretty simple website, but it says how to get to us and who works here and our philosophy. And we've been around for over 30 years now, and even since our inception, when I first started over 30 years ago, our goal has really been to offer high quality care that's very comprehensive to people without really paying attention to their ability to pay. Mm-hmm. You know, our goal is just to see people get really good care, and it's all sort of worked out for us. I somehow always thought for years that, well, we won't be open in another year, but somehow we've always just made it. And I think it's because our focus has always been on service and really caring for people. In fact, our motto is caring for you as family. Mm-hmm. We feel, you know, when I look down my patient list every day, it's a list of my friends, and my friends are coming to visit. And of course, we're going to take care of their health care, but I get to see my friends all day. And I feel at the end of the day that I've had a chance to have a very intimate connection with them and have them go away feeling healthier and better, with very positive steps to take in their life that are going to help them be a better person and a healthier, happier person.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Peter, for your time and answering all my questions. I'm sure that a lot of people will benefit from this interview. It's really helpful information.
You know, and I just would like to add at the end here, Sabine, that I am so glad you are doing this project, because unless someone has experienced this directly, or they've dealt with it for years, I don't think they could have a glimmer of understanding of how pervasive these kind of injuries affect people's lives. Mm-hmm. And, you know, again, it's kind of an orphan. It's in the closet. You know, people just don't know about it. And I think the more this kind of comes out, we're going to find there are many people who are dealing with these kinds of things. And yeah, you're just kind of getting all this information out there, and that there's hope, that it's not a death sentence, that there's still hope. I just think it's a wonderful thing, and I'm just so glad you're doing this. God bless you.
Yeah, thank you.